Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Great Debate. Great to see you here for our debate today on the resurrection myth or reality. My name's Hugh. I'm a fourth year history student and the president of the Evangelical Union. And on behalf of the EU, it's my great pleasure to welcome you today. This is our third week of our This Is Life campus campaign, asking our university the big questions of life and death and what Jesus has to say about these things. And we're really glad you could join us today and hope to see you at some of the other events every day, 12 till 2 this week. Just a few things before we begin our debate today. Hopefully you've received a feedback form in the barbecue line. That's a great way to let us know if you have any more questions about Jesus, about the EU, about anything you've heard today. So if you're able to fill that out over the course of the debate and pop it in one of the green buckets that are floating around, that'd be a great way to let us know you are here, and we'll get back to you with any questions you have. If you want more information about the Evangelical Union, we're a group of about 750 Christian students on campus who exist to find out more about the God of this world as revealed in the Bible. And next week, we'll be having three special talks, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, all at 1 p.m. To follow the conversation, because it's been great having these big discussions over the last 2 weeks about Jesus and what he says about life. So we'd love to see you at the rest of the events this week and Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, 1 p.m. next week, and all the details are on our website, thisislife.com.au. I'm going to hand over now to Paddy Benn, who's one of the staff who works with the EU. He's going to be chairing our debate today. Thanks again for coming. We do hope you enjoy the debate, and do make sure you grab 2, 3, or 4 sausages today. Thanks.
Well, I'm just going to briefly outline the speakers and the format for the next couple of hours. If I can introduce firstly our speakers. Speaking for the affirmative side will be the team on your right, on my left. Our first speaker will be Lee McMunn. Lee is a Scot, and he's here for a couple of weeks. He's from Scotland and works as a churchman. Our second speaker will be Ian. Ian works in town talking to businessmen and women about Jesus. And our third speaker, who arrived only yesterday morning, Krish. Once again, is from the... Yeah, we flew him in especially. Yeah, that's right. On our negative side, I want to introduce our first speaker, Yitzi. Yitzi's a student and a ragamuffin. That's how he wanted to be introduced. Actually, he wanted raconteur, but I said no, but you see, you've got it anyway. Our second speaker for the negative will be Angskar. Angskar works as a senior lecturer over at New South Wales University, and we welcome him to Sydney University. And he is also the organiser of the Sydney Atheists Forum. Have I got that correctly? Pretty much so, yep. The third speaker for the negative is John Forge. John is a professor here in the HPS department. The rules for the debate will be that we will go first affirmative, first negative. Each speaker will be given 6 minutes. There'll be one bell at 5 minutes, two bells at 5 minutes 30, and a continuous bell at 6 minutes until the speaker sits down again. The topic for today is resurrection, myth or reality. Our affirmative side will be taking resurrection as a reality. Our negative side will be taking resurrection as a myth. I want to now, would you please warmly welcome our first speaker for the affirmative.
Some of you may be surprised to hear words like persuasion and evidence from the lips of any Christian. But let me say straight away that both myself, Ian, and Krish are persuaded by historical evidence that Jesus of Nazareth, that is the Jesus who did exist about 2,000 years ago, a man that we could have met if we were around at the right time and in the right place, and who was crucified under Pontius Pilate, we are convinced that this same Jesus was physically raised from the dead. In fact, we are convinced that there are certain facts that everybody can be confident of and that everybody needs to explain. And we believe that the physical resurrection of Jesus is the most plausible explanation of those facts. Now, what are the facts that need to be explained? Let me mention two of them. First of all, the empty tomb of Jesus. And secondly, the transformation of the close followers of Jesus Christ. How do we know that the tomb was empty? There are many reasons that I could give to you, but let me give you what I think is the most persuasive explanation. It is widely believed that soon after Jesus' death, his closest followers appeared in Jerusalem and started preaching from the very beginning that Jesus Christ was physically raised from the dead. Now, they didn't claim that he was spiritually raised from the dead. Think about that. If they had said he has been spiritually raised from the dead, how do you verify that? That would be the easy thing to do, but they didn't do that. They chose the harder thing. They said that this Jesus, who was killed in this very city, has been physically raised from the dead. Now, why is that significant? Because what is the easiest way to stop someone in the very city where the person has been crucified to stop preaching that he has been physically raised from the dead? Just imagine, here we are gathered in Jerusalem. I've stood up and I've said this: Jesus, who was physically killed, has been physically raised from the dead. What is the easiest way to shut me up? It is to get the body. It is to bring the body and put it in front of me. Now, that didn't happen, and therefore we can be sure that for whatever reason, the tomb was empty. It doesn't prove that Jesus has been physically raised from the dead. You might need other reasons to persuade you of that, but I think it does demonstrate that the tomb was empty. So the first fact that we've got to deal with and have an explanation for is the empty tomb of Jesus. The second fact that all of us need to face is the transformation of the close followers of Jesus. There's lots of information I could give you from the reliable New Testament, but let me pick up a secular Roman historian called Cornelius Tacitus. This is what he writes, and he is not a fan of Christians, as you understand as I read this. He writes this: Christians derived their name from a man called Christ, who during the reign of Emperor Tiberius had been executed by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate. And listen to this. He says, "The deadly superstition, thus checked for the moment, broke out afresh, not only in Judea, the first source of this evil, but also in the city of Rome." The question is, why did it break out again? Again and again and again, Jewish messianic movements arose and died when their so-called Messiah was killed by the Romans. But this one didn't. This one arose again. And why was it? Because the close followers of Jesus, those who had walked with him, talked with him, and some who had seen him killed, they claimed to have seen him physically raised from the dead. What transformed these men who were despondent and whose whole world had collapsed to now be courageous, bold preachers of the physical bodily resurrection of Jesus? And not just to preach, my friends, but to suffer. Being a Christian back then was tough. They were mocked, and often they were physically persecuted, and often that they were killed as well. We have reliable testimony that majority of the close followers of Jesus were martyred for their belief. And that belief included the physical resurrection of Jesus from the dead. How are we to make sense of that? I think the one you can rule out as the most unlikely explanation is that they simply made it up. Why would they die for a lie that they knew was a lie? You know, people every day die for lies that they don't know are lies. But these people knew if Jesus Christ had physically appeared to them. How can you explain the transformation of the disciples of Jesus Christ? I'm not saying the only suggestion is that the resurrected Jesus appeared to them, although we think that is the most plausible explanation. But I am saying that we all have to deal with the transformation of the close followers of Jesus Christ. So what is the explanation of those two facts, the empty tomb and the transformation of the disciples? I want to say we've got to deal with them both together. It is unfair simply to say the empty tomb, maybe someone nicked a body. At the same time, you've got to explain the transformation of the disciples. We are convinced that the physical resurrection of Jesus is the best explanation. We are convinced we all have to deal with those two facts. We're pretty convinced that the team on my right don't believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus, but we'd love to hear their most plausible explanation for those two facts.
Thank you. I'll now call on the first speaker for the negative, Yitzi.
Thank you. There's a man in India today, a man revered by Muslims and Hindus, who goes by the name of Satya Sai Baba. I encourage all of you, when you get home, to plug this name into Google, Saibaba. This is a man who is a leader of a particular sect, a following, a cult, if you will, and whose followers ascribe to him such miracle working as levitation, spontaneous creation of small objects, the ability to make fruit grow from trees where such fruit should not grow, the healing of chronic and acute injuries, invisibility, changing water into gasoline, which is a great deal more useful than any of Jesus' tricks in today's political climate, the controlling the weather, changing the color of his cloak while wearing it, and several other miracles of the same degree. In fact, his followers claim these don't only happen when Sai Baba is present. They occur even around altars dedicated to Sai Baba. Spontaneous necklaces will appear at such altars. Now, we might ask what the significance is of one more cult believing one more thing about one more person who is claimed to be an avatar of God. But the number of followers that Sai Baba has today are conservatively estimated at 6 million. There are probably a lot more. And those who believe that the miracles of Christ, as so recorded on third-hand testimony and passed down by a few sources over a couple of thousand years, testify to his divinity and his resurrection, really need to square that with the fact that we have evidence of similar or greater weight occurring all around the world, even to this day, in much greater numbers and with much greater levels of persuasiveness. Why is it that we should trust four men with different accounts, or 10, or 20, or however many you want to claim as original followers of Christ, to give us an accurate account of what happened then, when we have thousands and thousands who have witnessed miracles today, whose testimony we can simply dismiss offhand? Lee asked why these people would die for a lie they did not know was a lie. It's an interesting point. People are martyred all the time, but they're normally martyred for things they believe to be true. So that the first generation, so to speak, of Christians were martyred seems to indicate quite clearly that they couldn't have just made this whole thing up, because the minute the ruse was up, they would have said, you know what, I'm not going to die for this, I was kidding. The problem is this does not account for the very real possibility that all of these followers of Christ, no matter how generous you want to be, both in numbers and in temporal realities, could very well have entirely believed everything they thought and still constitute a less persuasive body of evidence than the followers of Sai Baba today. The other main rough point that I think you have to deal with, if you want to hold the resurrection of Christ to be fact rather than fiction, is the incredible suspect circumstance that arises when we compare the rising of Christ from the dead, and indeed the entire life story of Christ, with the life stories of other gods from Mesopotamia and the Near East who predate him by hundreds and hundreds of years. For instance, and this is incredibly easy to find on the web, we know that many major gods and mythical figures are held to have birthdays on the 25th December. Buddha and Mithra and Vishnu and Shiva and Quetzalcoatl, the Aztec serpent god. 25th December has somehow gotten to Mexico, which is a point that I'm sure the Mormons would take far more interest in than most other strands of Christianity present here today. But the similarities are not just, oh look, they're all born on an equinox, solstice. The similarities between, for instance, the life stories of Osiris, Dionysus, and Jesus, Osiris being one of the primary gods of ancient Egyptian myth, Dionysus being somewhat of a party animal from Greek mythology, extend through, and I'll make this brief, but I encourage you all to really go and look this through the parenthood of a godly father, the godly father, and a human woman, low birth, miracles of water into wine, number of disciples equaling 12, death, resurrection, the whole schmozzle. Their titles are largely identical. And what this seems to quite clearly indicate to us is that there were stories happening hundreds of years before Christ which were the story of Christ. This seems to strongly indicate to me an issue of plagiarism rather than a self-fulfilling prophecy written into pagan myth. Thank you.
I know you're keen. Let me introduce you. I'll now hand over to the second speaker of the affirmative. Yeah.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's generally well understood that when you're dead, you're dead. And you're generally speaking a long time dead. And when the first Christians began proclaiming that Christ is risen, it was a self-evident stupidity. There was no parallel for it in Judaism. The ancient Greek world into which Christianity went, actually written at the Areopagus, were the words that there is no resurrection, and there was no desire for it. What people wanted was escape from the body, not the resurrection of the body. Why do otherwise moderately intelligent people like the people on the sinister side of the chairman, why do we, in spite of being moderately intelligent and reasonably well-educated and believing in science and being modernists or postmodernists, believe in such what seems like a self-evidently silly belief, that not in a mythical way, which is the key difference between the ancient Middle Eastern views about the dying and rising God, which nobody believed was in real time and space and history. It was simply echoing the rise and fall of plant life. There's no one who's read about those myths who thinks that was in time and space, a real place you could see it. What Christianity says that a real man was really murdered by a real set of soldiers and really walked out of the grave. It is quite distinct, although perhaps dying and rising is a long wished for ideal and it's often pictured in the creation. But it's quite different, I think, when the early Christians say, you killed him, which is what they were saying in Jerusalem, you killed the Prince of Life, God raised him, and we saw him. That's what they were saying. Not that it's an interesting mythological picture of reality, but that we actually saw him. The Apostle Peter would say we ate with him, we drank meals with him after he rose again from the dead. To draw a parallel between some of those ancient religions and what the early Christians were saying just shows a failure to understand one side of that alleged parallel. We're arguing and have argued that there are two basic things going on here about why the resurrection is real. There are certain facts of history, that there is scholarly consensus even amongst atheists. For example, Gerd Ludemann will be absolutely in agreement that the early Christians had experiences of resurrection. And the question is how you explain it. There was a missing body. Honi Soir, some years ago, coming up to Easter, had a rightful joke about, you know, the holiday has been cancelled, we've found the body. And it is true, if the body is found or good evidence that it stayed in the grave or was robbed, the whole show's over and I'm going to retrain for something else. There's an empty tomb and there's a bunch of ordinary people who are absolutely unstoppable. Not because they've got certain views about reality, but because they say they've got news that he actually rose. It's easy to sort of pass mocking jibes at the quality of the evidence in the New Testament, call it third hand or whatever else. I think it's fair to say, in the way that I was brought up with the myths about the New Testament. I don't think the myths are in the New Testament, but there are an enormous amount of generally received wisdom in our culture about the hopeless inaccuracy of the New Testament. I want to suggest to you one of the things that many scholars, when they start reading the eyewitness account, which is the key thing to actually go and listen to the witnesses before we sort of mock them or jibe, is to see the weird things that they include. Let me give you some of the marks of their honesty. When you read the four accounts of the resurrection, perhaps you could throw in the Apostle Paul's very early one in 1 Corinthians 15, it's quite difficult to get all the appearances and who was where in perfect alignment. Which is, of course, exactly what you expect if you're doing honest history, where eyewitness accounts will often be an agreement on the central things, but all sorts of areas where it's hard to get it quite right. In fact, a well-known Australian scriptwriter, Tony Morfitt, said as an atheist as he began to look at the Gospels in order to write a documentary, what disturbed him as a reader of good history was the fact that there were differences in the accounts. If they're all in perfect agreement, and you go to a law court, that's thrown out as collusion. Well, and that's how I thought the New Testament was written. A few guys were bored. They sat under a palm tree and said, hey, let's start a religion. Matthew, could you write a gospel? Mark, could you write a gospel? In which case, they'd agree. But there are differences in the accounts, which is exactly what you expect in honest eyewitness accounts. One of the other key things that people who understand the culture take very seriously is this, that when Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote their accounts of the resurrection, all four of them choose as their primary witness women. Now, I say this not because I agree with it, but it was simply a well-provable fact from any number of quotes we have from that century that the evidence of women was worthless. It was simply not taken seriously. In fact, Josephus says that from women let no evidence be accepted due to the weakness and temerity of their sex. I don't agree with that, but that's what they said. And yet in all the Gospels, it's women. Why? Because like it or not, the early Christians, as they were telling the histories, found that it was women who were the key witnesses before Jesus then chose to appear to the other disciples. There is no description of the resurrection. You can go to the alleged all the other Gospels that the church threw out. They'll give you ridiculous descriptions of the resurrection. None in the Gospels. Why not? They didn't see it. They are not deceivers. They're not liars. They're honest men giving honest accounts. Therefore, there's no description of the resurrection event. But of the empty tomb, the later appearances, there you find good, solid recording of what they saw. So we put it to you that the explanation that the empty tomb and the great transformation of these men is best explained by the fact that Jesus rose from the dead. Thanks.
I'd now like to welcome the second speaker of The Negative.
Hi, welcome. I wish you would be a bit closer, but if you like to be there closer to the sausages, that's fine. As long as you leave a few for me. I'm happy that, I guess you are Lee. Lee apparently also saw or that Lane Craig's arguments, and luckily I did the same. So I've got a few things about the four facts that people often claim happened. So people often claim that there was some person died. I mean, we can all agree that probably happened. People often claim that there was an empty grave, an empty tomb, that could happen as well. And nobody says that there are people around who sometimes see dead people. That happens. And they're really convinced that they see this dead person. That happens as well. So the argument is the only thing that could explain this would be a resurrection. So imagine for a second that you would get a phone call in a weekend that a friend of yours was in a terrible car accident. You rush to the hospital, you go where you think he should be, and there's a person telling you, listen, he's not here, he's in Melbourne. What do you think? Oh, the only reasonable explanation for me is that he is the son of the Creator. No, your reason, you would think something else. I will give you a few seconds. Imagine you go to a hospital, you expect to find somebody dead, and he's not there. What do you think happened? Okay, so there are many reasons that could happen. Paul, people mentioned Paul. So what we have are stories of people who believed that there was a bodily resurrection, and that's true. There were people who believed this. Who were these people? These stories were written down. The first one was by Paul. Paul wrote this down in 50 BC, so something like 20 years after the fact. He was at this point since 15 years, something like a leading figure of this small cult, this small fan club of Jesus. So he would have a good reason to write something fantastic about this guy that they were all fans of. That was 15 years after the fact. That's not a reliable eyewitness account. That's something like a fan club would write. The other four Gospels that came later, they were written down in the 60s. Mark, I think then in the 70s, 80s, and the last one was John, somewhere in the 19th to 120. So just imagine how many years this is. This would be something like the first account of something spectacular happening, say something like John Lennon being shot, would be written now. And it would be written now by the fan of the John Lennon Association. And would you say, oh, this is probably an eyewitness account? No, the fan of the John Lennon Association, Paul, did never meet Jesus. He had an appearance of him, and he mentions in Corinthians 15 his experience in the same sentence as the experience to all the other people. So the other people, he treats his experience, which happened after Jesus, according to the story, was gone and wasn't a body, just like this experience to all the other people. So we don't have an eyewitness account of 500 people seeing Jesus. We have an account of the fan, of the Jesus fan club, 15 years after the fact, telling us that 500 people saw Jesus because he saw it himself. So that puts it a bit into context. So, and there's also, Ian mentioned something like, oh, they are all similar. There's a good reason why many of these stories are similar. It's typically, and you should really Google this, it's quite easy, you should really look at how these three Gospels came into existence. Mark was first, and up to 95% of what he wrote was actually copied by the other two guys, Luke and Matthew. So they just took his book and they just improved on it. So their way of approaching it was like Wikipedia. You find a story, you like it, and you improve it. But you don't improve it based on sources, but you improve it based on what feels good, what makes a good story. So the story got better. So if you would do this at the uni, copying something like 95% of your mate's work, that would be called plagiarism. But back in then, it was just making something like a better, good story, and they really liked it, and that made the thing much more attractive. So, and we know that they made things more attractive. There's evidence of this. So there are small differences between the stories. So for example, John, who wrote later, for example, put the date of the crucifixion on the day before Passover. It was typically after Passover. Even apologists accept that John did this to convey theological meaning. There are stories about dead people walking. There was not just one dead person walking. There were many dead people walking. People accept that this was done to convey a theological meaning. You mentioned the Gnostic Gospels. There is much of evidence people in that time just changed stories all the time just to make a point. They weren't meant to be literal accounts. They were meant to convey a good feeling, a theological feeling. So there's an argument that we... if people have an extraordinary story, it must be true. Can you think of a small group that has extraordinary stories that is mocked, ridiculed for their beliefs, and where you think it's not true? Say groups that believe in aliens, small cults. Just because they are mocked and feel persecuted doesn't mean that their belief is true. It just means that they might be treated unfairly. So, I mean, if it wouldn't be Christianity, you wouldn't accept these arguments. So we would call this something like an urban legend, maybe a myth, but it's not reality because there are no sources. They are very much a lot later. So thanks, and...
Thank you very much. We'll now turn to our third speakers for both sides. So I'll now call on the third speaker of the affirmative for his summing up.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name's Krish, and I'm excited to be here. And I think it's great that you've decided to be involved in this debate. This question of whether Jesus really rose from the dead really matters, because without it, Christians do not believe that Christianity is true. So if the resurrection is only a myth, there is no reason to actually be a Christian. Christians only believe that Christianity is worth following if Jesus really historically rose from the dead. Now, some people would argue that we cannot possibly believe that Jesus rose from the dead because miracles can't happen. Because miracles don't fit the normal scientific laws, and therefore, as a result, they can't possibly have taken place. Well, that is precisely the point why the miracle is so important. You see, if I said to you, look, I am, and please be awake here and don't mishear me. Imagine that I said, look, I am the Son of God. And to demonstrate to you the truth that I am the Son of God, I will do a miracle. And this miracle is if you leave one of your sausages from the barbecue out in the open air for 5 minutes, it will grow cold. That is not enough of a significantly exciting thing to convince you I am anyone other than a normal human being. The fact that Jesus really did die, was crucified by the Roman government at the behest of Jewish religious leaders of his time, the fact that he really was dead, that he stayed in his tomb unassisted by medical support, and that on the third day he rose from the dead. The fact that dead people do not normally rise up is evidence that Jesus is more than just a man, that he is God. Now, because Christians would say, actually, what is the evidence that you need to support that? How can you demonstrate that? What can you possibly do? You can't ask for that to happen again, because we're now in the area of what we call historical evidence. And some people say, no, you just can't say that, because miracles, by definition, cannot occur. It's a little bit like the person that says, look, how would you demonstrate the statement, all swans are white? You cannot possibly gather all the swans in the universe together to show that they are white. What you need to do is to try and falsify that statement. Now, how many black swans would it take to disprove the statement that all swans are white? Well, actually, you only need one black swan to do that. And do you need to have that black swan on your person that you can kind of nip it out and show everybody, here is a black swan? No. Do you need to have been able to see that black swan yourself to disprove the statement that all swans are white? No. All you need is one credible example, one credible witness to demonstrate that all swans are not white. You just need one person that's seen one black swan one time in history that you can rely on. Now, the Christian faith is based on the premise that God exists, that Jesus is the Son of God, and that is demonstrated by one major miracle, which is the resurrection. If that took place, then miracles can occur. Now, what do we have? We have four accounts of the resurrection written by these disciples. Now, the fact that they have worked from a common source document, possibly Mark's Gospel, that doesn't undercut the fact that there is that, as was mentioned earlier, that brutal honesty about the women were the first witnesses, that the disciples do not come out well in this story. The disciples continually get things wrong. The fact that actually, even at the end of Matthew 28, Jesus is resurrected, and there they are, and still some people don't believe. Now, if they were just editing it down to make it look better, they would have cut out all those awkward bits of the gospel. But the fact that they left it in, and even those disciples look stupid, is evidence that they were writing a warts and all account of history. So I would say to you, look, the resurrection of Jesus is the point of falsification. If it really took place, it is worth believing. Miracles are the evidence that God exists. They are not normative. The fact that they transcend normal laws is the evidence that God is involved, that God is showing his credentials to be believed. And actually, to disprove the statement that miracles can't occur, all you need is one miracle to have occurred one time in history. And we're saying to you this morning, yes, here is that miracle that disproves the statement that miracles can't occur. And that statement is Jesus Christ really physically rose from the dead, unaided by medical assistance, and he was seen. And those gospels were circulated during the lifetime of people that could have refuted it. All you need is for people to gather up and to challenge those gospel statements. But the fact that the church now exists today is because those gospels stand as historically reliable documents circulated within the lifetime of people that could have refuted it. And it's worth comparing the historicity of the gospels with other ancient works that are trusted. And the fact that the earliest copies that we have of those Gospels are within the lifetime of people that could have refuted them. So thank you for listening. Looking forward to the next part of the debate.
I'll now call on the third speaker for the negative, John, to bring your rebuttal.
I have three things to say. First of all, the resurrection is physically impossible. It conflicts with the laws of nature. Secondly, it's logically inconsistent. And thirdly, I'll give you a simple explanation as to why the story has been put about. When somebody dies, certain irreversible changes happen in the body after about 5 minutes. The brain structures decay irreversibly. Who does science here? Thermodynamics, the second law. Entropy of a system can never decrease. So the body is an entropic system. The structures of the brain decay, particularly in the Holy Land in Easter time, which is quite warm. So it's physically impossible. The laws of nature do not allow anybody to rise from the dead. But Jesus rising from the dead is logically possible. The statement itself isn't a self-contradiction. But you can conjoin it with something which makes it inconsistent. Now, here are two statements. Tony Abbott always tells the truth, and Tony Abbott lied about his election costings. You can't assert those two statements together. You can only accept one of them. Taken together, they form a contradiction. Now, if Jesus is the Son of God, then he must partake of God's nature. And theologians from Aquinas to Calvin have told us that God's omnipotent. God is all-powerful. Therefore, you can't kill God because he's all-powerful. So if Jesus is the Son of God, he couldn't have been killed. And if he wasn't killed, he couldn't have been resurrected. So either Jesus was not the Son of God, or Jesus was not resurrected. You can take either one, but you can't take both together. They form a logical contradiction. The third point, why is this story put about? Well, if you read the book of Joshua, you'll read the miracle of Joshua, where the sun stood still in the midst of the heavens. There was never a day like it nor since. And Joshua beat the bad guys at the Battle of Jericho. If the sun stood still in the midst of the heavens, then it couldn't have been moving. Therefore, there seemed to be biblical support for the geocentric view of the universe. We don't believe that, and neither did Copernicus, neither did Galileo. So Galileo said, well, the Bible's written to accommodate the senses of ordinary people. To put the Copernican view in the miracle of Joshua is far too complicated. We want to try to persuade the ordinary folks that miracles could happen. More sophisticated, intelligent university students don't need that kind of thing. Neither do my learned friends on my left side or the right side. The Bible simply accommodates ordinary folk and tries to persuade them to believe in the existence of God. So it makes up stories. The resurrection is simply a made-up story, one that doesn't have any factual basis. It was made up to accommodate the sensibilities of ordinary people. It can't be true, because on the one hand, it contradicts the laws of nature. Now, you may not think that's persuasive. You might say, well, God can perform miracles. By the way, this speaker begged the question. I presuppose the point to be addressed, but I'll leave that one to one side. Perhaps a more telling point is my second point about a logical contradiction. How can God, the Son, be killed? If God can die, surely we don't want that. If you're Christians, you don't want a mortal God. You want a God that can't die, a God that can't be killed. I think that's perhaps the most telling point I have to make against the possibility of the resurrection.
On your behalf, I want to thank the three speakers, both of the affirmative and the negative. We're going to have a short break now, and when we return, we're going to allow each side to either restate their case or introduce some new material, and then we're going to ask each side to start asking some questions of the other side, and we're going to get some interaction from both sides. So I'll encourage you now to take a break, have some sausages, and we'll return in about 5 or 10 minutes. Thanks.